And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of your favorite celebrities. This is Gold Mines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome, world, to an all-new episode of Gold Mines. You know what we do here. We get inside the minds of amazing people. This week will be no different. It's actually more special. This week is so special because I'm actually going to be honored with the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. This year marks the 25th anniversary of that award. And guys, to be honored and share a space with so many comedic legends, Dave Chappelle, Richard Pryor, Whoopi Goldberg, Tina Fey, Jay Leno. I mean, you can't name a better group of people to be aligned with. The dope thing is that I've actually had the pleasure of talking to some of those amazing guests right here on Gold Mines. Eddie Murphy, David Letterman, to name a few. And what great conversations we've had. Yeah, of course, Eddie, you're known for fucking amazing characters. You're known for great character work from your years on SNL, from portrayal of different characters throughout movies. We can go Nutty Professor. We can go down the line. But what you've done in Coming to America and Arsenio, you as well, you guys kind of put stamps on these fucking people that were a discovery later on. It took some years for a large part of that Coming to America audience to realize that you guys were the people that you were in that film.
I texted that to Arsenio last week. I was like, hey, you know, I don't know if everybody knows that we're those, all of those characters.
Absolutely
I did
not.
An interview with Oprah last week, and I was talking about the movie, and I was like, yeah, and then I'm the old Jewish man. She was like, what do you mean the old Jewish man? I said, that's me in the barber. She said, you're the old Jewish man? She's seen the original Coming to America. She's seen this. She just realized that, you know, I was that character.
I promise you, it was a discovery for most, if not all, that you guys were the characters in the barbershop. And then
That's fly.
It's dope as hell. Now you're talking about even my guy, Sexual Chocolate. You're talking about the pastor. Like, there's so many things that you guys took and made your own, but that carried the movie. And when we go into part two, not to be a spoiler for the audience, because I want you guys to support the film. Once again, it's available on Amazon. Guys, I want you to fucking realize that they went and bought them back. You guys didn't leave those guys where they were. You did something I think that was amazing for the fan base at hand, which was revive those characters and bring them back. Was that a priority for you guys?
Oh, we had to bring them back, I think.
Yeah, all those characters the glue for the movie, for the comedy in the movie for me. Because the character Akeem is kind of more like almost like a straight man, you know. His characters, other characters, get to be balls out funny.
Favorite one that you guys did?
I love the barbershop scene, but I did a new one, a witch doctor or shaman named Baba, which Eddie was supposed to do, and I'll let him tell you that story how that unfolded. But I
nasty love- woman, by the way. Very nasty woman that you portrayed.
Now, she wasn't a woman. That's a man.
Is it really?
Yeah. The old witch doctor, that's a man.
Are you sure?
It's funny. We had one of the things that didn't make it into the movie where the old Jewish guy is at the party, at the after party, and he's talking to her like, that's a lovely dress you have on. It never made it into the movie. But yeah, it's a man.
I didn't know. Okay. All right.
By the way, Kevin, there's a joke that Wesley, your new co-star for the future, he looks at him and says, whose auntie is this?
Yeah, that's why I thought it was a woman, because Wesley referred to her as aunt. I didn't know. And I thought, you know, when the scene was there with James Earl Jones, I won't say what's going on because we'll leave for audience. I thought that it was like a family member, a close relative. And then it seemed like you was very spelly. You know, like I ain't never seen a man do the spells like that. So I said, it's got to be. I just went with the assumption. It's got to be a woman, which I didn't know. Okay.
All right. Yeah, I thought it was Miss Rudolph.
Yeah, I stand corrected. I'm sorry for assuming. I apologize. Talking about the movie is one thing, man. I got to talk about the friendship, man. You guys are friends. You guys have been friends for quite some time, man. And, you know, in this business, these relationships come very far, few and in between. How have you guys maintained this level of friendship throughout these years? How are you guys still fucking close? Please give me the recipe, because I got niggas falling off like flies.
Hey, yo, I have a lot of niggas that fell off like flies over.
Jesus.
You will have, as you go along, you have less and less and less and less friends.
Yeah.
He's one of the few that's been around for, you know, 30, 40 years. But trust me, bro, your circle gets smaller and smaller and smaller as you go along.
It absolutely does, man, which is why I'm envious of what you guys have, what you guys have built. And, you know, those friends progress as you do more things together.
More Gold Mines with Kevin Hart after this.
When something happens to your car, you might say,
"No! My car!"
But what you really need to say is something that can actually help.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And just like that, State Farm is there to help you file your claim right on the State Farm mobile app. So, just remember, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
Save big money on your next project with help from Menards. Move water where you need it quickly with a Barracuda sump pump. Sump pumps keep your basement dry when big storms hit unexpectedly. Get a half horsepower cast iron Barracuda sump pump on sale now through May 5th. Hurry into Menards. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
We return to Gold Mines, hosted by Kevin Hart.
We're talking about legends giving us an opportunity to fucking get another visual of what they became legends with. So don't miss it. I've seen it. I had a cheat sheet. I got to see it already. Very funny movie. And I got to shout out Jermaine one more time. A young comic fucking went in there and he's amongst giants and did his thing, man. Good for him. Eddie, being around those comedians, I've seen him being around those comedians. Was it one of those things where people were trying to one-up funny each other all day?
Oh, Tracy Morgan. Tracy Morgan is funny before he wakes up. He's funny and he's always, he's amazing to be around. As a matter of fact, Tracy Morgan was the first person cast in this movie. Eddie was like, "I'm doing this movie and I'm putting Tracy Morgan in it. Everything else will come after that."
But yeah, I don't know if one up and nobody wasn't, I don't know if it's one up and Tracy just is always being funny. I don't
know. He's on.
One up and.
He's always on.
Yeah, I'm not a one up and kind of nigga. You know, I'm around other comics. I don't be trying to, you know, see who's the funniest one and none of that kind of shit.
But you do understand that being in your presence, a lot of comedians feel like they need to put on a certain display of funny to get the approval of a you. It's whether you realize that or not,
I don't feel like a comedian is be trying to go out of their way to be funny when I be talking.
Oh, no, wait a minute, Eddie.
Stop it. Come on, Eddie.
We've seen people do the worm on your kitchen floor to make you laugh.
Stop it. Come on, Eddie.
You're talking about an isolated incident. It ain't like, you know, every time I'm around comics, they be putting on, doing their shtick.
I can say that for the younger generation of comics,
they mostly shut down when I'm around the young comics. They shut down. Then when they go do their set, they'd be like, "I was at Eddie Murphy's house, and he had a toilet this way." And I said, "Ooh, I'm at Eddie." Be turning to a bit of some shit. They'll be trying to be funny to me,
not to you. I can say I've never fallen for the over funny attempt. Around Eddie. I kind of went the other route in my younger time when, you know, I had the opportunity to be around him and then it progressed.
Before you was middle age.
Yeah, before you can't say I'm 41 is not middle age. Like, I don't know why you
were in your younger time. I said
41 is not middle age. I'm still considered a young man.
41. Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely still considered a young man, but 40 is the beginning of middle age.
No, it's not. Yes. 45 is when you're
45 is the beginning of middle age?
Yeah, 45, because you're closer to 50, which is actual middle. That's when you're in the middle. Everybody treats 50 like you're in the middle.
50 is the middle of 100.
Yes, but once you cross 50.
One in 10,000 make it to be 100 years old.
One in 10,000.
50 is not the middle. Especially
This is how I know you're getting old.
Hey Kevin, I'm telling you, Kevin, you're going to be middle-aged before this Zoom is over. You're going to be middle-aged before the Zoom is over. Let it go.
You want to know how I know he's getting fucking old? He just shot out a percentage of people that make it to a certain age, which means he's researching. He's researching right now to see where he's at.
Research. I'm learning. I'm an intellect, nigga.
Yeah, well, you become that once you realize.
Research that.
You're 60 now. Let me ask you a question. Do you feel 60?
I feel like Eddie.
Okay, what does that mean? What does that mean?
It means I feel like I could beat you in a street fight, nigga. That's what I feel like.
Yeah. What's the last street?
Wait, Kevin, I've seen you box. I've seen videos of you.
I whip Eddie ass.
Nigga, we have two different weight classes.
I whip Eddie ass. You know he in the boxing heavy, so two
different weight classes.
How much you weigh, Kevin? How much you weigh?
I'm about 150. 150, 154. Solid though.
Yeah.
Solid.
What you fighting at right now, Eddie? What's your weight?
190 pounds.
All right, I'm not fighting Eddie.
He's gonna fuck you up on the rope.
Yeah, no, I'm not. No, he gonna bulldog
with that old man strength. I got that old man strength too. I got that old man strength.
You still bowling, Eddie?
I ain't bowling months, man.
It's in your house, though.
Yeah, but I don't have nobody to bowl against. I don't want to just be out here bowling by myself. Yes. Yeah.
You know, he wanted to bowl, right? And I go bowling. First of all, anybody with a bowling alley in their house, you already know some shit with the lanes. It's not going to be what it's supposed to be, right?
What's the insinuation here?
I'm saying some shit with the lanes.
If you have a bowling alley, period, somebody has to go and reset shit and every now, but you know, if you're in a house, you got to go do this shit.
If it's in a house, I mean, I would assume that if somebody wants to bowl, they would take care of the lanes. And I'm not saying that.
No. The bowling alleys go out at the bowling alley too.
Yeah.
Bowling alley. If somebody's throwing a heavy ball down there.
Yeah.
So every now and then the shit, somebody got to go and they say, aisle seven, somebody go down to fix it at the bowling alley.
Yeah, man. Look, I hear you. I'm just saying that I would think that going to Eddie's house, it would be set up differently. I'm not saying that the lanes were dry. They definitely didn't have oil on them, how I'm used to, right? So, you know, the ball wasn't coming back. My ball couldn't hook. It was a lot of shit. A lot of shit.
Where are you used to bowling at, nigga?
I'm used to bowling at fucking places that take care of their lanes. How about that? How about that, Mr. Murphy?
My shit is way flyer than the regular local bowling alley that you be going to, nigga, on Ventura Boulevard. My shit is fly shit, nigga.
The only thing, you know what pissed me off about that day? The one thing that, like, stayed with me, and you know how we talk about, like, anger, how I was just talking about for the boxing, how they need something that acts as motivation? When I left Eddie's house, it wasn't the big house. It wasn't the massive fucking view or any of that. No, what pissed me off is we went the bowl and I said, hey man, I don't have no shoes, you know, I don't have no bowling shoes. And he said, we got shoes, and he had the fucking bowling shoes, and the motherfucker gave me a pair of sweat socks with the shoes. Until this day, that's what pissed me off the most. I said, how successful do you have to be to have any fucking size shoes and socks for whoever comes over? I said, I gotta get that. And that was my anger and ammunition. It was my fuel, Eddie.
That's what keeps you going.
That's what kept me going all this time. That was my anger and ammunition.
Yeah, you know, the older you get, the less people be around you. It's not just a show business thing. The older you get, the less, you know, you wind up being around mostly your family and the really people you have really close bonds with.
Well, here's a question for you. And this one has always made me curious because I know how I am in my neighborhood, right? So, you know, you get to a point where you live a certain way or live in a certain place, and there's people that live around you. You know, I know where you are, Eddie. Are people, is there a close-knit neighbor-to-neighbor thing where you live? Like, or do they not fuck with you? Like, do they not fuck with you?
Minds their business. You mind your business, and they mind their business. Your next door neighbor mind their business. You know, when you're driving through, you give a wave and all, you mind your business.
Have you ever had a situation where you're like, yo, man, such and such keep trying to fucking talk to me, and it's starting to piss me off. You know, like they're making their
not
way.
Here, not at this house. Back in the old days in Jersey, I used to have that because the house wasn't in a gated neighborhood, so people would show up, and it would be like, you know, obscure people like Dizzy Gillespie is at the gate. I'm sure he lived around the corner, so every now and then Dizzy Gillespie would come by the crib. Be out in the kitchen. In the kitchen talking to Uncle Ray. What the fuck is Dizzy Gillespie talking to Uncle Ray in the kitchen?
Hey Eddie, Kevin, I don't know how this ended, but I was texting with Eddie once and he says, let me hit you back. I think Suge Knight's in my kitchen. I don't know what that meant, but I didn't know whether it was a colloquialism, But people love Eddie.
I had Jermaine Jackson show up at my fucking door one time. True story.
Jermaine's been here many times.
Jermaine just showed up at my
door. I invited him usually.
I didn't invite him. I didn't even know.
Live in a neighborhood that he's in or something?
I think his fam. He had a friend that lived in the neighborhood. This was at my old house.
Brother, please tell me you was nice to him. No, you wasn't mean to him.
No, what the fuck you gonna be mean to Jermaine Jackson for? It's still Jermaine Jackson.
All right, okay.
Yeah, you can't be mean to a fucking member of the Jackson 5. No shot. Now I was confused. Like, you know, I opened the door and Jermaine was there. He was dressed in like, it was almost like a concert outfit. True story.
Always dressed like,
always
dressed in stage clothes.
You'll see Jermaine at the sushi restaurant and he'll have epaulets and like a soldier hat.
No. I thought I missed the show. I really did think I missed the show. And he's at the fucking door and he go, man, you know, I had to stop and see you. And I said, Jermaine Jackson? He said, yeah, man, you know we love you. I just had to stop and see you, man, and just tell you keep doing it, man. And I was like, thanks, Jermaine. And that was it.
They're real cool.
Yeah.
When I first came out here, the Jacksons was the only famous black people. The Jacksons and Prince, Magic Johnson, and Rick James. That was all the famous people.
That's
the
it.
The Jacksons was so nice to me when I first came out here. The whole family was nice.
This is Gold Mines, hosted by Kevin Hart. We return to Gold Mines, hosted by Kevin Hart.
Dude, I'm honored to be on the opposite side of this conversation.
Let me just say that I have great admiration for you. And maybe you've heard this story, and maybe I've told this to you in person. But if I haven't, I've told it to many, 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 many other people. And I find it very satisfying to tell. I believe the first time you were on the show, do you know the story I'm about to tell?
I want to hear it. No, tell
me. Okay. The segment producer named Brian Tedda comes out to me during the commercial. The band is playing and you're about to be introduced. And he said to me, he said, I don't know. He didn't really give me a pre-interview. And all he would say to me was, don't worry, I can make anything funny. And I thought, oh, it's one of these guys. Let's see how this goes. So I was really excited and quietly hoping that you would come out and start perspiring and stumbling and muttering and perhaps even twitching. So you came out, you sat down, bang, zoom. And at the end of the two segments, I said to my friend Brian, holy crap, he can make anything funny.
Wow.
I've never seen that machine. That was the only time I've seen that machine in my experience. So it was great. And I love telling the story because I was so happy to be proven wrong. It was great.
You know what? I remember the moment. I remember the moment clear as day because I went through this phase. You know, when you first start and, you know, David, you start getting the levels of success and there's a marketing and promo that's attached to it. Right. And you're in position to now get across those late night stages. And, you know, it was the first time that all the pre-interviews were being thrown at me of the things that you want to talk about and the direction that you want to go and give us some things. And, you know, that's how they help navigate the conversation. And more importantly, it just helps the host. Right.
Yeah. It really is an aid to the host. And also, I think the goal historically for the pre-interview was to make both the guest and the host look as good as they're going to look in 8 minutes, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember saying, you know, I was like, I don't like the pre-interview. I feel like I'm good enough of a talker and I'm good enough in a conversation to pick up something if it's down and to amplify it if it needs the volume turned up or down. Like I think I'm kind of good at that. I don't want to give the pre-interviews. I said, is there any way where we can just talk? And it got to a point where it started to become more of a believable thing, where the publicist that I was working with, I guess, started to convince the, you know, the producers that I would be fine, because I was finding discomfort in it. And I remember doing your show, and I remember them going, okay, well, we're just going to, you know, just give us a couple of things. And my publicist gave some bullet points, but I didn't. I was like, we're going to be fine. This is me on David Letterman. I'm so hyped to sit in that chair. I couldn't wait to sit in that chair. It was the biggest thing for me to sit in that chair. It was, you know, these are moments of I've arrived and it's all happening. And I swear to you, I remember that conversation.
Yeah. Well, I'm you're flattering me, but the impressive part of that was you. But you know, I think you're right. The idea, I mean, I got it from when I was a guest on The Tonight Show, and they held that very rigid, that you had to go through the pre-interview, and then you did another pre-interview when you got to the studio. And I think it was just because they wanted everything to be as slick and as smooth. And Kevin, you'll be surprised to know that not everybody can equip themselves talking on TV for
ages. Absolutely.
So it was all boats rise with the tide. And I think it was to help people who in show business, in spite of the fact that they couldn't hold a conversation.
you know what, man? Right now I have an opportunity. Right. I have an opportunity to talk to you and ask you questions. And, you know, I could go down the traditional lane and ask you questions where people already know the answer. We know that you've been on late night. We know that you spent years on late night, and we know a lot of the stories. And if you don't know, it's not hard for you to educate yourself and find out the story. I want to talk to you about your now. Right. And here's why. You seem to have such a different calm over you now. And I'm watching your show on Netflix. My guest needs no introduction. And your approach to it, you know, the top of the shows, you're loose with the crowd, the audience. What is the difference? What do you feel is the major difference for you in your world of talk show now than what it was when you had Letterman?
Thank you for the observation. And I'll tell you, there is a deeper response here than the question might suggest. Mm. But not doing the show that I did for 30 years, I have realized that my direction, attention, and energy was misplaced for a long, 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 long time. And that life, specifically my life, went around me like a stone in a stream. The water breaks and goes around it. So you don't get the benefit of the stream on either side of the stone. You just get what divides the water. And that was me. I was so fixated on the show that other parts of my life, or anybody else's life that was close to me, was overlooked or second or third tier. So what I have realized since then is that you know, you're not the most important person on television. You're not even the most important person in your family, but I certainly behaved that way for a long, long time. So in approaching the Netflix show, the schedule has greater humanity. We're only doing a handful at a time. And I think you probably understand what I'm talking about.
That's so clear.
Yeah. Because you're in talking to you now, I can see, being on the other side of this equation, you get it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I stopped doing it, and you mentioned the word calm, and that was never associated with me, and still can't be associated with me to the degree I wish it was. But it takes the frenetic aspect, which typically is artificial, and lets you see really what is not artificial.
I told this, I forgot who I was talking to. I was talking to somebody else on my podcast, man. And I was telling them a story about like Will Smith. Will Smith said something to me that rocked me, fucking rocked me, man. And it put me in a position to no longer want to give advice, but I'll give information. Will Smith said something to me. He said, dude, I found out that I was like a selfish individual. He said, and the reason why is because when I gave advice, it was for people to become me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, when you give advice and you're telling people what to do, you're telling them the way you did it most of the time. And if people don't choose to do it like that,
yeah,
sometimes you get upset and go, well, then you don't want to win,
mm-hmm,
or you don't want to be successful. When in return, what you're saying is, you don't want to become me. He said, and I had to realize that. I had to realize the selfish approach to what I thought was help wasn't help at all. It was a moment of me in my ego. And mm-hmm, and at this age, once again, an older man now who sees life in a completely different way. And just how you and I are talking, the conversation I had with him was mind-blowing in the same way, because it's going down the same road of evolving and maturing. And he said, now I give information and people have a choice to either use the information or not. So when you say, have I done it? No, because I feel like people have, that's the beauty of life. The beauty of life is discovery.
Right. Yeah.
And who am I to take your discovery away?
That's right.
And who am I to prohibit you from discovering? Now, I can say, hey, let me give you some information about something that I know through some experiences that I've had, just to give it to you. And if you choose to take it, once again, great. If not, great. But ever since I talked to Will, I've taken away that piece of me that used to love to give advice,
mm-hmm,
of how I got to and here's what you do.
Yeah. I always said to myself, I don't feel like I'm qualified to influence people in matters of conscience. And
wow,
you're exactly right. You're kind of wanting to demonstrate a superiority if you tell them what to do, as opposed to just dispensing advice. But still, it's a fine line. And you understand how, if you're telling them what to do, that resentment can grow from that. So you have to be careful. So Will is exactly right, but still, to dispense advice, you have to be prepared for it might get sideways on the person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right now, you and your world of entertainment, you know, you said something to me early on where you were like, Kevin, you know, you're in it. And you said, you're not, you know, you're on the other side of it. Is there a stop date for you? This is another question I love to ask. Are you at the point where there's a specific date where it all ends, or is this just now? Is it something to enjoy in a space of comfort that you do, and you may create other things, you may do other things? Where are you at in the business right now?
Geez, that's
I'm getting good at this, David.
I tell you, here's my trouble, or one of my troubles. I keep forgetting my chronologic age. I keep actually forgetting it.
I love that.
And I was talking to somebody today, and she reminded me, it was a wife of a good friend of mine. And she said, you know, the twins of so-and-so are 61 now. Now, the last time I saw the twins, they were 14. And I thought, holy shit, those kids are really old.
Wow.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm still older than the alarming age these kids are.
Wow.
So I keep forgetting that. And I think people do. They put it away. My goal is, I feel like the person that I operated as for so many years was reading the wrong handbook.
Mm.
And that's what I'm trying to, and it comes reflexively, because you're not in that circumstance, so you're not going to behave that way, thank God. And I'm fond of saying I probably should have quit 10 or 15 years before I did, because I bypassed a lot of things and behaved in ways that was not helpful, not friendly, not without hurting some people. So in terms of how long will I pursue it? I don't know, you know, good question, but I don't know. I think geez, it's just a miserable ego of people like me, where you think, I'll keep doing it until I feel better about myself. Well, good luck.
Now with these streaming platforms, which you now have partnered with, you've seen how it's taken off and you're now available in all of these countries, 250 different countries your talk show is available. Is it mind-blowing to you to see how the broadcasting distribution has grown and the direction that it's going in?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you put it aptly. When I was in L.A. trying to become successful as in comedy or show business, there were three outlets. Fox hadn't arrived yet. But what I have known, what I have seen and experienced firsthand is that the entertainment, especially men and women doing stand-up, men and women doing stand-up comedy now, their comedy is so far more sophisticated than the stuff that the 200 or 300 of us were doing back in the 70s and the 80s. And you would think that with all of these, it's like if the NFL expanded to 50 teams, you would think that the talent would water down. And that's what I would expect with the streaming platforms. But it doesn't seem to have. It seems like, it's a great place to revisit the inventory. It's like the Library of Congress. Here's everything that was ever produced on TV. And if you would like to educate yourself or you wanted to see it again, it's all available. So there's that part of it. Take it or leave it, like it or not. But that does exist. There are so many more chances. And what's wrong with more chances for anybody? Well, nothing really. You know, you'll sink or swim. Doesn't make any difference if there's 1,000 possibilities or if there's 50 possibilities. If you're good enough, you're going to get in that lineup. And I'm overwhelmed at the stuff that it's like going through an encyclopedia. You don't think you get to LMNOP, whatever. You think, well, there's nothing in this that will interest me, but you're wrong. There's always something else out there that will interest you. And the number and people, I know nothing about these guys and women who are successful and they have multi-million-dollar deals to do their comedy shows and express their comedy. And once a month, I'm surprised by how good it is. And who is this? I don't know. So I think it's a good thing for the culture. I think it's a good thing for show business. I don't think all of the streaming platforms will survive, but yeah, more opportunity in almost any walk of life is a good thing.
I had Judd Apatow on the podcast, and Judd's been a good friend of mine for years. Judd's a person that was a part of my start, right? As are you. And I just want to make sure that I take the time. We're nowhere near done, but I got to take the time to just give you what I like to call your flowers. I want to make sure that you know this. People are now stars because of the association with you. I'm going to say that again, and I want to make sure this lands, okay? I want to make sure that this lands. People are now stars because of the association with you. Going through the David Letterman pipeline was significant enough in several careers that it gave them value to basically become who they now are. At some point in time, although you're on the journey of new and you know, erasing a lot of this old, I want to make sure, David, that you sit down at some point in time or stand up when you're fishing next and just laugh. Just take a second to laugh at the amount of stars that are now able to live the life that they live, to do the things that they're doing, because in the beginning of their career, the stamp of approval came from you. Well, and I know it's a crazy thing to think about.
Yes.
Right.
You're kind to say these things, and you're very kind to say this, and thank you. And it's something to think about. and I will think about it. And let's just say it's true. I wish now, hearing this from you, that I had been aware of it in the process. I would have been far more generous to people coming through our pipeline than maybe I was, because you have to manifest a large degree of ego and selfishness to be in show business. But hearing this now, Kevin, makes me think, holy crap, if this was going on, I should have paid closer attention to it. I should have nurtured this more. And maybe I did. I don't even know how you nurture something like this. I mean, maybe just by virtue of being there, people benefit from it. I don't know. But now I wish I had actually tended this crop, as we say in the Bible. Do they say that in the Bible?
I don't want to say that they don't, but I'm willing to bet that they probably do. I don't want to say they don't, because I'm like, if I was a strong reader,
I'll check it when I get back to the house.
I would have to know it inside and out to say that they do. So that's a way to back up your partner. I don't want to say they don't. You can say that confidently,
right? It's just, right.
I'm here for you, right? I'm on your
side.
You
show me where they don't say that.
Yeah, that's it. That's all I'm saying. No, I just thought it was good to say that to you, man. I told Judd, you know, the same way I told Judd, I said, dude, I said, you know, there's so many careers in comedy that have popped because of your blessing to put them on screen. And, you know, I said the same thing to Ice Cube. There's certain people that just have a talent with just an attachment to other talent. And that attachment is acted as a slingshot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether you see it or not, I'm a student of it. I sit back and I watch it and I rewatch it. And I clearly understand. Clearly understand.
I saw what you're talking about in Johnny Carson. I saw it in Steve Allen. And I saw it at the Comedy Store when Richard would come in. I saw it happen there. So I've recognized what you're saying in others. Because, you know, especially Richard and Johnny and anybody else at that level in those days, that was powerful. And I understand the magnetic attraction there.
When you look back at it and you talk about just the stand-up time, you know, back then, and you talk about just the conglomerates, you know, that were around that you were a part of, you know, you're in that circle of comedy, of comedians. Who was the most mind blowing to you back then?
When I first got there in 1975, I got to Los Angeles, and the person that just knocked the wind out of you was a guy named Tim Thomerson. And here was a guy who later had a very successful career as a film actor. But in those days, he would destroy the room. I mean, really beat up the room. And then I guess then Freddie Prinze would come in. And same thing. And here was a kid, he was 19 or something, maybe 20. I don't know. The other person like that was Robin Williams. And then Richard, you know, these guys were the Rocky Mountains, you know, you're standing there looking up, and I'm sure I'm leaving other names out of there.
It's a great list.
Well,
it's a great list.
You know, Joan Rivers had the same effect. She didn't, I don't think she worked the Comedy Store, but she worked, in the neighborhood, certainly, and was a great influence for people. I'll start with that. You know, but the list is longer than what I can recall right now.
That's crazy. I could talk to you, dude, for hours and just really be engulfed into the world of story.
Did you go through the Comedy Store?
I didn't come up in it. I came up through New York. So getting into the Comedy Store wasn't a problem when I finally got out here. But I was never engulfed into the the world of it. Like I would come and I would do a set here and there, but I was never like a part of a consistent rotation because at that point I was already on the road. I was doing comedy clubs and colleges at the time. So I didn't spend a high amount of time in the LA comedy circuit. The New York is where I fought tooth and nail and got into that circuit, you know, and didn't want to leave it. You know, I was doing six sets a day in the New York comedy circuit. And the LA one, I felt like it was different from coming from the New York one, because I felt like the comedians in LA, I felt like didn't want to, everybody always performed as if that's the night that they were going to get shows. Mm-hmm. And what I felt LA lacked was the world of workout, right? New York embraced the world of workout. During the week, we're working on material. I got my paper, my pad, and I'm doing my jokes. And on the weekend, here comes the bigger shows and everybody's doing their best to bring it. And, you know, in LA, every show, people are doing the best of the best that they got. And it's all about the kill, because who's in the audience?
That's right. Well, this is exactly what I'm thinking as you're telling about this. There was no room in LA. When I was there, it was the Comedy Store. That was it. Mm-hmm. And then there was a place called The Horn, which was kind of like a showroom, and they would have music and maybe a comic. And then Bud Friedman came out with the Improv. So then you had two places, the Comedy Store and the Improv. And it was LA. And one night, William Morris would buy out the house. One night, ICM would buy out the house. And so you just didn't have the opportunity, or in my case, too afraid to actually mature, because you had your 5-10 minutes, and that you knew that was all you were required to do. And you knew that would get you on television. So you didn't really grow. You grew to the level of what will get me on the Merv Griffin show, and then you stop producing. Mm. But what you're describing is a community of growth where, by God, I know I got to keep working. I know I got to keep working. But in Los Angeles, you didn't want to have a bad night, because even if there wasn't somebody in the audience, I can remember one time I was there was a comedian named Pete Barbeauty who was very funny and a club act. And avant-garde and interesting and peculiar, but very funny. And he had to cancel a couple of gigs. So he recommended me and a buddy of mine, George Miller. And one of these things was a banquet in Idaho for a real estate company, Salesman of the Year Awards. And of course, you know, you're going to have comedy at Salesman of the Year Awards in real estate in Idaho. So I get up there, and it's a podium and a gooseneck microphone. And I do my 20 minutes, dead silence, get on the plane and go home. And later I find out that the Pete Barbeauty's manager called up Freddie DeCordova at the Tonight Show and said, listen, I keep hearing that you're having thoughts about bringing Letterman on the Tonight Show. Let me tell you, I just saw the kid bomb in Idaho. So it was, you just didn't know, you know, this was the world we were living in. I mean, he was right. I bombed in Idaho. I got no problem with that.
Yeah, I did. That's a fact. It didn't go good for me. I bombed there. It's all right. It's not a big deal, guys. That was a bad one for me. Idaho is not going to be a strong market for me. Write it down. Write it down.
Look, it's their problems, not mine.
Guys, I want to thank all y'all for listening to this special episode of Gold Mines, where we got to listen and reflect on my time with some of the greats, Eddie Murphy, David Letterman, to name a few. And I'm truly honored and thankful for this award and for you. Guys, I'm excited to see what's next. But until then, I just want to say bye. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Gold Mines. Peace.
Gold Mines with Kevin Hart is a SiriusXM and Laugh Out Loud Radio production and executive produced by Kevin Hart, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, and Eric Weil. Produced by Danny Sellers and Leslie Guam. Engineered by Danny Sellers.